are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 26th. My name is Michael Brooks. This is a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, a doubleheader. Cal Winslow, no neutrals in Harlan County. We're talking about the miners' strikes, the history of strikes, and the role of labor insurgency in saving democracy. Then, Gene Bajlan, professor of history at Missouri State University. Why is Betsy DeVos demanding that Duke University and University of North Carolina, their Middle East studies programs, serve U.S. national security interests? That's what's happening here. We'll talk about academic freedom, the Middle East, and touch a bit on potential crisis with Iran, even as Imran Khan, the Pakistani premier, says that Indian actions in Kashmir could set off a nuclear war in the subcontinent. But don't worry, when he's not fighting off impeachment, Trump's going to be able to negotiate that. We've got some sound for that later. Trump offered the Ukrainian president, the Justice Department, to help in investigating a Joe Biden conspiracy theory. Part about his son, very real, very Biden swamp. Secret servers, not so much. Acting national intelligence directors testifying before Congress as we speak. And the whistleblower who initially brought this testimony forward tentatively might come forward if they get proper protection. Lula's defense team is denied a request to include The Intercept's reporting on how the prosecution of him was corrupt and politically motivated. That sounds like a corrupt and politically motivated ruling. Even as a team of progressive legislators led by Raul Grijalva, Deb Haaland, and Ro Khanna put forward a comprehensive resolution demanding labor, indigenous, Amazonian protections, as well as the release of political prisoner Lula da Silva and a probe into the Department of Justice's role in backing the corrupt Lava Jato investigation. Inequality grew, including in the heartland, according to the latest census, even as medical costs continue to skyrocket. They've surpassed $20,000 per person this year, hitting a new record. Go team, even as Elizabeth Warren continues to be slightly Buttigieg-esque on what exactly her healthcare plan is. She gave a CFR questionnaire as well, which reinforced standard Democratic foreign policy and problems. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Matt is on the road. He's waterboating himself.
Down on the bayou.
But we've got a great, I think this triad has actually never happened before. This is exciting.
First time for everything.
Yep. The Jamie, troika of ideology.
Wait, what is your ideology?
Just get it done.
Just get it done. New Jersey.
No bumps in the road.
No bumps in the New Jersey Jeeves.
The Klubeck ideology.
The Klubeck ideology. I relate to the Klubeck ideology. My ideology is a fusion of Mao and Klubeck.
Yeah. I'm an anarcho-communist who likes to get things done.
There's a business book called Good to Great, and it's sort of like a combination between that and the Viet Cong. That's how I describe my politics. Were you around when we did the New Jersey Jeeves bit?
I don't think so.
Okay, because we were taking like the, because you're like, you know, you have to like deal with Sam and manage him, and we were just thinking of him being, and you're like, it's all right, sir. Take a frickin' breath. Jeeves, where are the tickets? It's okay, they're right here on my phone, sir. Very good, very good. And you just like manage and calm him down, and
that's part of it.
And like Jeeves, actually, basically, like essentially, what I'm trying to say is Brendan is the power behind the throne. There's a lot of like speculation about like the power dynamics and all of everything, like, you know, what's going on here. But what I'm saying is that it's not like it's Brendan.
I'm not going to reveal any of it so that we keep people guessing. I mean, I think when people build their own narratives as to what's happening, it keeps people engaged. And, you know, I'm all for that.
It's fun to think.
As long as it's not too salacious.
How Jeeves-esque of you to say. Very good, sir. People think about their own narratives. It makes them more active in the Twitter analytics.
It's fun to think of these things in terms of your fantasy life, Michael. Just the accents people have and the things they say. It's better than real life.
It makes it so much more tolerable. You know, my comedy versions are obviously not in Brendan's case, but certainly for a lot of the people that I do impressions of, an enhancement. In Brendan's case, it's just like some type of acid. It's like some type of like LSD, PG Woodhouse parallel reality, which I find amusing.
Me too.
Still waiting on mine. You're still trying to figure out how you can pull that one off without offending anyone.
Right. I mean, look, the obvious one would, I mean, look, to be, I could feed some of your lines through a Bernie or Bust Bill filter, and that would be funny. That'd be funny. Like, just, we gotta broaden our horizons.
Good. I'm always saying that.
Got to broaden the horizons. I know I always talk about this, but street action and union militancy. That one works.
Yeah.
All right, folks. Here's what we are going to do. This yesterday. Jamie, you understand what's happening with Ukraine, right?
Yeah.
You were talking. I mean, it's super simple one, right? Yeah. You asked what was happening today, and it was like a relief, because instead of being like, well, there's a private security contractor named CrowdStrike, and then they talked to a Democratic staffer 3 years ago, and then Trump, you know, said the N-word on The Apprentice, and somehow Putin's involved, like the usual pinballs of these stories. This one's pretty straightforward.
The time when my brain shuts off.
Yes, right, exactly. This one's pretty straightforward. This one is, and then somehow that turned into Robert Mueller tchotchke art, and we're all exhausted. This one is...
Refreshingly simple.
Refreshingly simple. Joe Biden's son is on the sits on the board of a Ukrainian energy company. That is the swamp in and of itself. But of course, it's metastasized into a broader conspiracy that is not true, which includes actually literally something that Joe Biden said at a meeting of the Council on Foreign Relations while it was being taped. That somehow Trump thinks is like. Basically, Trump thinks that Joe Biden publicly admitted to like a significant crime in Ukraine at like a Q&A at the Council on Foreign Relations. And it ties into a broader conspiracy theory about, I think another thing that's happening here is that Trump is confusing the CrowdStrike investigation with Hillary's private email server. So I'm trying to tease all of this together. But the bottom line is that he basically thinks that those Nicolas Cage movies about like the secret treasure map in the Constitution are real, except they're in Ukraine and they're going to put Joe Biden in jail. And
Lock him up.
That's what it is. It's just season two of Lock.
It's just, yeah,
him
exactly.
Or her up.
It's just lock him up, reloaded. And so I pointed out yesterday that, you know, what the Trump administration is going to do for their spin is they're going to say, hey, I got my buddy, the president of Ukraine, right here. Does he say that he's being threatened or asked to cooperate in our political campaign in order to get the funds that Congress already allocated for him? I don't think so. And of course, because the president of Ukraine is in the world's periphery dealing with Russian influence and does not want to piss the United States off, obviously he's not going to contradict it. And lo and behold, I believe this was this morning.
This was yesterday after the show.
Yesterday after the show. Look what happened here.
President Zelensky, have you felt any pressure from President Trump to investigate Joe Biden and Hunter Biden?
I think you read everything. So I think you read text. I'm sorry, but I don't want to be involved.
Pause it. I am really sorry. I know this is obnoxious of me, but this is literally my impression coming to life.
Yeah,
This is exactly the bit we did yesterday.
Yeah, I saw it after the show. I was like, "Wow, Michael and Sam are the Nostradamus of 2 hours from now."
Now, I mean, you see what you read, no? And Trump's just like, "Wow, what a smart cookie! I love this comedian. This guy's a former comedic actor who starred in a Ukrainian television show about a school teacher, I believe, who became president." And then leverage that popularity to become president. He's also Jewish.
Oh, hell yeah.
He's kind of an interesting guy, actually. I don't know enough about him, but, you know, I don't know. He might be on the pro-austerity side of things, but he's at least, biography-wise, he's interesting.
I appreciate the postmodernness of that story.
Yeah, that's like hyper-normalization.
Yeah, he's basically what actually happened is Adam Curtis engineered a Ukrainian coup and installed a crisis actor for his next BBC doc. Okay, let's go.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be involved to democratic, open, wibbery elections. Elections of USA.
No, you chose the word.
I think good phone call. It was normal. We spoke about many things, and So I think, and you read it, that nobody pushed me. Yes.
In other words, no pressure. There was no pressure. And you know there was, and by the way, you know there was no pressure. All you have to do is see it, what went on the call. You know that, but you could ask the question, and I appreciate the answer.
He literally
said he's having a normal one.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly what he just did. Just watch the Majority Report, just in case you want to skip a Trump press conference. We've got you a couple hours in advance.
Also, once he really gets into his answer that Trump's been waiting for, Trump does not break eye contact with him the entire time. It's just...
No, Trump
is
totally
normal. We spoke about many things, and so I think, and you read it, that nobody pushed me. Yes.
That is a sound drop waiting to happen.
Did that nobody push me is definitely a sound drop. Did I hit my lines? Yes, you did. Very good.
You could tell he was an actor, right?
You could tell he wasn't an actor. He was a comedian. That's the other part of my bit is that Trump is confused with him being a stand-up and all of his bribes involved. Maybe we could get you a Netflix special. Maybe even HBO.
I'd watch that.
I would totally watch that. All right, folks. Sam loves reading ads. Watch him do something he enjoys, and then we'll be right back.
Hey, support for today's show has come from Carrie Uma, which marries old school design with new school ethics. They're shoes that are made responsibly. They feel crazy comfortable, and they provide effortless style. I think everybody knows here I've been trying to up my style game a little bit. I've been told for years I got to start wearing a better class of shoes and sneakers. And these guys, they make their sneakers by hand with premium natural materials. They have canvas, which is from cotton sourced via fair trade initiatives. They have a cleaner premium leather, which is made with water that's been reused and treated with zero chemical waste output. Their outsole is even made of natural raw rubber. Plus, their shipping footprint balance is zero. Offsets, folks. It's amazing. They ship worldwide and here in the U.S. as well. They even have express shipping. They can deliver your shoes in just 2 to 3 business days. And then, if for any reason they don't fit perfectly, you send them back free of charge. I'm loving these things. I have them right here, as you can see, on my feet. I got the high top, black leather. It reminds me of my youth, but they look nicer, frankly, and they're made they're more substantial. And of course, like I say, they're made more ethically. So these are great sneakers. They're super comfortable. They look good. And now for a limited time, our listeners can get an exclusive 15% off your first pair of Carrie Uma sneakers. Go to CarrieUma.com/majority to get 15% off. That's CarrieUma.com/majority. 15% off today. CarrieUma.com/majority.
Very good. All right, we're going to take a brief break. We'll come right back with Cal Winslow. He's a journalist and editor, and we're going to be talking about the Harlan County strikes. Everybody needs you. No, you can't make everybody equal. Although you got Buku family. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Cal Winslow. He is a labor historian. He's author of the recent piece in Jacobin Magazine, No Neutrals in Harlan County. Cal, thanks for being here.
No problem. My pleasure.
What's happening in Harlan County? Tell us about this strike.
Well, I think this strike protest might just be winding up for now, at least what I, if what I read in the paper this morning is true, but never mind. Typically of the eastern Kentucky coal fields and the southern coal fields in particular, the employers have been viciously harsh on their workers whenever they felt called upon to do something. And this time what they did was they just closed a couple of mines and fired the workers and didn't give them their paychecks and left them really in an isolated part of the world like eastern Kentucky, left the miners with very little option except to try to take some action, and they did by first shutting down the railroad tracks and closing off the mine from making it impossible for the mine to sell the coal that it already had out of the ground, and then constructing a camp with supporters there that lasted for more than a month now, I think, and got some attention. And for us, I guess, it also brought back to the memory the bloody story of Harlan County, which goes right back to the 1930s and before then. And that's kind of what interested me, being a historian, I guess, that In times when there's trouble and when workers are moving, it always seems that we hear about Harlan County.
Mm. Will you tell us that history, that story of the 30s and before in Harlan County?
Well, the American coal fields were organized relatively early on, and the northern fields, Pennsylvania, Ohio, across that belt, were pretty strongly organized in the 1890s when the United Mine Workers of America was founded in Columbus, Ohio. And a union, a pretty powerful union, organized on an industrial basis. That is, everybody who worked in or around the mine would be a member of the union. It was a pretty strong union, except there was the feeling that the southern fields, as they were called, southern West Virginia, eastern Kentucky, and Virginia, were always a threat to the strength of the competitive fields because they were being non-union. They could always be relied on to keep the supply of coal moving, and so numerous times under numerous leaderships, there was an attempt to bring what were called the southern fields into the union. And this happened in the 1910s. And it happened for our subject this morning, today, it happened in the 1930s, particularly difficult times for miners, for all workers in the country. So in 1931, when one-third of the coal miners in Harlan County were unemployed and many of those people had been evicted from their homes, and there was no other work in an isolated area like that. The miners struck, and it led to bloodletting on both sides. The intervention of the federal government, and a fight for a union that lasted for almost a decade.
Tell us about the song, Which Side Are You On, and how it fits.
Yeah, I wish I could sing it for you because it's,
<Me too. laughs>
it's very moving.
Yeah.
But the sheriff of Harlan County at the time in 1931 was J.H. Blair. He was a particularly nasty fellow, I guess, but there were plenty like him. He was involved in a raid on the home of a coal miner's organizer. They came in the middle of the night, as they would, and broke up the house searching for the miner who wasn't there, and terrifying the family. In response, Florence Reese, who was the leader's wife, wrote the song, Which Side Are You On? And it became kind of an anthem, first of the mine workers, and then I think for the American labor movement in general. And it says, hey, they say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on? And been sung at many strikes and rallies ever since.
What about the United Mine Workers as a union? Where do they sort of fit in terms of their militancy and kind of in the ideological spectrum historically?
Well, I think they shifted. They haven't always been in one particular stance. But an interesting thing about them was, to go back to what I said, they were always an industrial union, and in that sense, implicitly, a challenge to the American Federation of Labor, which was based on craft unions. Now,
can you explain the difference to people?
An industrial union would be, say, in an automobile plant.
Mm-hmm.
In an industrial union, everyone would be in the same union, one union. If craft unionism prevailed, the electricians would be in one union, the machinists in another, the janitors in another, the secretaries in another. Does that help?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep.
So a big plant might have 20, maybe more, unions involved in representation and negotiation.
Got it.
So there's always been a movement for industrial unions in the U.S. It came mainly from the left, from the socialists on the left, going right back to the founding of the labor movement. But it came to a head in the 1930s when the United Mine Workers, led by its president, then John L. Lewis, felt that it was time, with the Roosevelt administration now in office, it was time to organize the workers in American industry. And Lewis and the UMW broke from the AFL and set out to do just that. And in an incredible few years, they were able to organize workers in the automobile industry, the steel industry, the rubber industry, chemicals, farm equipment, you name it, and brought millions of workers who were deemed to be unorganizable by some because they often were immigrants or they were unskilled, brought these people into the union movement in a particularly powerful way, into the Congress of Industrial Organizations, or CIO. And so John L. Lewis And it certainly wasn't all up to him, but at least as a symbol, John L. Lewis will forever be remembered as the person who led to the unionization of the workforce, really, in the 1930s.
And just looping it back now, because we're going to expand the conversation in the next several minutes. But the basically, the federal government has agreed to spend $3.72 million to retrain Kentucky's Black Jewel coal miners. I have an enormous amount of skepticism about what exactly this retraining will entail and for what economy exactly. The back pay checks for the miners have been cut for those in West Virginia, but they're actually still waiting on their back pay in Kentucky and Virginia. And my understanding is that, I mean, this strike was literally about not only were they not getting, you know, back pay, I believe that they had actually taken money back out of their accounts that had already been deposited. And of course, this incredible strike happened, and you know, it earned national attention, and Bernie Sanders came and showed solidarity and support. But it's still, it's incredibly important, but it's striking that, you know, it's fighting for such a bare minimum in the sense of really reflecting on just the relentless war against workers and organized labor for the last several decades.
Well, you know, you've said it as well as anyone can, I think, there. That's absolutely right, that even though led by sort of West Virginia teachers, things seem to be maybe opening up in the labor movement a bit. We're still mostly on the defensive, and people are afraid to ask for too much. And so even with all the discussion of wages not having improved really in almost decades, we hear of a good settlement being 1 or 2%, you know, hardly keeping up with inflation. And I think that's what's going on with these workers in what's traditionally one of the very poorest parts of the country.
What do you make of that, of this emergence, though? I mean, the West Virginia teachers also in Oklahoma and California, the Chicago strikes in 2012, great union leadership there. And once again, fighting, you know, in that case, fighting this, you know, Democratic mayor, who was one of the most, you know, active anti-union mayors in the country, the ever odious Rahm Emanuel. We have the GM strikes happening. Looks like a little bit of a similar dynamic of GM at this point, I believe, is at $30 billion profitability. And the strikers are asking for really quite little. The company responded by cutting off people's health insurance. I guess, again, in that sort of similar dialectic of the real incredible relentless war on workers, but at the same time, and you as a historian, you have an article coming out, which I'm incredibly excited to read, about the Seattle general strike. You know, what's the positive end of this equation as well? That, I mean, if, I guess my question, if people are willing to take the risk to do something as extreme as a strike, when does the shift start to become of, well, you know, yeah, we're taking this huge risk, so how about, you know, equity in the company? How about a 30% raise, you know, or so on?
Once again, you know, you've said it, but I would only add that you know, the appetite increases with the eating, that you might say, for those of us on this side of things, we have to hope that seeing workers back in struggle, seeing people make gains, even if they're small, is going to be a lesson for other people, and it will lead them to possibly ask for more. But I think that we probably are going to need more activity before we see really important increases. On the other hand, I'm an active supporter of California healthcare workers, union, the National Union of Healthcare Workers. And over their past 10 years of existence, you wouldn't know that there was a problem because they've been winning good contracts and they've been increasing benefits. And they're a democratic union, and they're militant, and they go on strike all the time. So, you know, one never knows. You can't tell what can be won until you try.
Indeed. And that may be my final question. You know, what is the difference between, you know, you talk about a successful example like the California nurses. Now, you know, and obviously there's some structural factors in place. You know, we haven't even gotten into, I mean, one of Bernie Sanders' most important, genuinely revolutionary proposals would be getting rid of so-called right-to-work laws. But when you think strategically and you kind of balance somewhere between the California Nurses Union and then maybe the heads of other major unions, even sort of, you know, helping run interference for candidates running against single-payer healthcare, which would seem to be one of the most kind of basic things that any union person, anybody with an interest in the middle class and working people would obviously support as a policy unequivocally. Is this also maybe like a time of reevaluation, even on the left, of, you know, going like the ground is more willing to take risks and do radical things than the leadership typically, and starting to think more around working on that revitalization instead of maybe, and, you know, forgive me, but, you know, maybe folks who've, you know, put in some really important work, but are also kind of, you know, used to being the Washington Generals to some extent for the last couple of decades.
Well, I think a very strong argument can be made that the most important changes have come about not just in society, but also in the labor movement itself, that they've come about as a result of movements from the bottom up.
Yep.
We might say. So to go back to Harlan County, really, that era symbolically began, in a sense, with these obscure coal miners in eastern Kentucky who had just had enough. And then, going back to what I said about John L. Lewis and the movement that began at the time of Roosevelt's election, what happened was coal miners apparently heard of the new administration in Washington and got the idea that President Roosevelt wanted them to join a union, and started flocking into their union headquarters literally by the thousands, so that there were reports from union officers and organizers saying they couldn't keep up with the number of people who wanted to be in a union. And it was that, it seems to me, that said to John L. Lewis and the others, hey, we can do something, but also, you know, looking back at that period of time, we better do something, because along with everything else, and I don't know that Bernie Sanders fits right into this picture, but people are starting to think of different ways of going about things, doing things, and that includes workers today, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I think that you're absolutely right, and we need to really keep an eye on what's going on with the rank-and-file workers, you know, especially at a time, I shouldn't end up with this, but a time when the ordinary General Motors workers are trying to run a strike when their leaders are trying to stay out of jail.
Well, there you go. I think you distilled it. I guess I have to say I'm more charmed by those ones than the centrist wonk ones. At least there's some fun to it. But Cal Winslow, I really appreciate your time. People, read this great piece, No Neutrals in Harlan County, and look forward to a forthcoming piece in the Monthly Review Press about Seattle's general strike. And I'll just say, I mean, in addition to it being a fascinating piece of history, it was a major point in sort of, I would basically radicalizing America's oligarch class. because they were so terrified of what was possible. Cal Winslow, I really appreciate your time.
I appreciate being involved in the discussion. And so thanks very much and keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much. Take care. All right, folks. We're just going to take a brief break and come right back with Jean Bajelon. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here, joining us now, the second player in our doubleheader, Jean Bajelon. He's a professor of history at Missouri State University. You can find his writing in outlets like The Jacobin. You can find him regularly on TMBS. He's fresh off of the Chicago TMBS live show, in fact. Jean, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Michael. It's great to speak to you today.
Thank you so much. So a lot of conversations about censorship, about this and that. I have no problem, actually. I think some of the criticisms of a sort of culture of censorship isn't the right word, but kind of control and constant kind of monitoring is correct. And I do think that there does need to be a sort of commitment to openness in some respects, openness in all senses. But, you know, the right makes a lot of hay out of this stuff. And then when there's like a actual literal threat, not a cultural or stylistic conversation, you're speaking about the human rights of Palestinians, we're going to cut your funding, maybe even fire you. That is the only time that actual academic freedom is threatened in this country. And that takes us to the extraordinary thing happening at Duke, and I believe also UNC and Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education. Gene, what's going on?
Well, there has been a letter published in the Federal Register basically criticizing the Middle East Studies program that is run jointly by Duke University and the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. It's not a particularly big Middle Eastern Studies program, but it's obviously fairly prestigious. Duke is a well-known university. UNC Chapel Hill is a very prestigious university as well. And this letter has basically been criticized in quite chilling terms, the activities of the Middle East Studies program there, accusing them of bias and so on and so forth. And this really hits a number of different points related to the sort of the broader debate taking place in the United States pertaining to campus freedom. So, you know, as you mentioned in the lead-in, there's a lot of complaints that students are, you know, refusing to listen to alternative perspectives, and they're your friends in the intellectual dark web make careers basically complaining about how their freedom of speech is being sort of stifled.
Even but, you know, a lot of constantly this is, talk. I'm going to take to the New York Times to talk about how I can't talk.
Yeah, and this, right. You know, this is obviously kind of a little bit bizarre, given the fact that these individuals usually have very large platforms. And of course, we have seen perhaps excesses in very small cases or very marginal cases in sort of particular institutions. You know, people focus on Oberlin, and I think it's Evergreen, right. Mm-hmm. and some of the University of California systems where things perhaps have got out of control or people have acted in an irresponsible way. But there are thousands of universities in America, and you know, individuals on the political right often need to come to speak in these places, and with very little problem. And if there are protests, they're usually, civilized and within these sort of realms of respectability. But yet we have this kind of discourse that, you know, people on the right are kind of, you know, being persecuted in universities. Now, what we've seen here, though, in this case, is the full power of the American government, well, being sort of deployed to threaten the Middle Eastern studies program, which receives federal funding. There's a Title IX program, which they have in the United States, which is designed to capacity build, train people up in languages, prepare people for the careers in government, careers in business, and also careers in education. And so we had this letter. What triggered this whole event was an event held by the Middle East Center in Duke and Chapel Hill, in which there was a discussion of Gaza, And it included individuals, obviously, from Gaza who discussed the impact of the Israeli blockade on that region. And it also included people from, you know, respectable think tanks in Washington and so on and so forth. But this provoked a local Republican congressman from Raleigh to forward a complaint based on sort of the assumption or the sort of accusation that this had been an anti-Semitic debate and people were engaging in all kinds of anti-Israeli and anti-Semitic tropes against against Israel. And, you know, this is the sort of classic conflation of, you know, criticism of Israel and, anti-Semitism, often deployed by the political right to confuse that issue. But, you know, people, you know, this individual had not, for example, this congressman hadn't attended the event and was basically going off sort of secondhand information. Now, sort of reports about that particular event, that makes the point that, there were a diversity of opinions. But the problem is, increasingly, politicians are critical of sort of anything which perhaps doesn't immediately
fit within their own. Department of Education? This is disturbing and problematic, but and typical. Everybody, in fact, I think especially as we actually start to see some resurgence of anti-Semitism in the United States, including terrorism mm-hmm. aimed at the Jewish community, the fact that people who just defend Israel's conduct anytime, anywhere, any place, from occupation to the, indiscriminate killing of civilians, and the fact that they've said any discussion of a sovereign nation state's policies is anti-Semitic, they've done an incredible amount of work to turn one of the greatest poisons in human history into a joke, frankly. At least until quite recently. Moving forward, I think that, so that this somehow, this letter gets the Department of Education now, if I understand correctly, is actually threatening funding.
Yeah, that's right. So there's this Title IX funding, which has certain strings attached. And this has always been the case. And it sort of comes out of this Cold War tradition of area studies where, there was sort of a need for specialist knowledge on various regions of the world during the Cold War. And, basically the Department of Education is making the claim based on very little evidence. It doesn't actually cite much evidence except for example, the titles of particular classes. Or it doesn't look at the content or types of or the names of conferences that were giving at the university to make the claim that the university is not using the money appropriately. It isn't sort of training people to go into government. It makes accusations that it's actually quite ironic. They accusing them of not sort of funneling people into government careers, which is bizarre given the fact that there's no career counselor at that program. And are they trying to sort of dictate how people should, use their education and do they have to go to a particular labor quota in the State Department or the military if they learn a foreign language? So there's all these accusations. They accuse the program of doing esoteric topics which aren't really related to the national security of the United States, which they claim is the sort of function of these Title IX grants. And this is, there is a certain element of truth to that, but, the language on these grants are pretty broad, and they talk about building cultural competence.
Right.
And, of course, that means sort of delving into deeper cultural issues. So one of the things that they highlight in the letter is a conference on Iranian cinema, which they don't see as having a relevance to American sort of national security interests. But if we're trying to build up cultural competence about a Middle Eastern culture, then it is a very relevant topic.
Right.
The fundamental problem is that these individuals don't have any competence to make these judgments. There's a very good example of this in the letter. For it complains that, Islam is being shown in a positive, too positive a light, or is being focused on too much, which is deeply problematic and straight up Islamophobic, but it also talks about the lack of focus on Middle Eastern religious minorities. And one of the religious minorities that they mention is the Kurds, who are not a religious minority. Kurds are Muslim, Sunni Muslim, part of the sort of majority of the Islamic world, which just demonstrates the complete ignorance of the people writing this letter. It just comes straight out of sort of an Islamophobic approach.
Could be plucked from a Harris book. I'm moving forward. I mean, we'll loop back to this, and this is a bigger problem, but I do want to touch on a couple of other issues actually emerging from the corollary of this mindset, but even in obviously a far more dangerous fashion. What do you read as the last couple of days' state of play with Iran? I mean, a lot of us breathed a sigh of relief and laughed when John Bolton was humiliated by Donald Trump. That was good for a couple of hours. But it still seems, I mean, you basically have an administration almost saying, you know, happily that they're sort of a security subcontractor of Saudi Arabia. Certainly how Saudi Arabia moves, the Saudis, you know, so these jokes about the Saudis will, you know, they'll fight till every last Pakistani soldier or Sudanese soldier is killed for them. What is happening in the last couple of days? At the same time, I mean, Iran is certainly winning the kind of global public relations war because at least in this instance, they're right. I mean, you know, they are right about who destroyed the agreement, the JCOA. They're right about, many aspects of their critique of, you know, the genocidal U.S.-Saudi war in Yemen.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of like an escalating game of chicken where, you know, parody becomes reality. I think there was a couple of months ago, there was an article in The Onion in which, John Bolton was saying an attack on Saudi Arabia is an attack on every American or something like that.
Right.
And then we come to a position where basically the administration is putting forward this discourse. You have people like Pompeo, you have Trump sort of really pushing this sort of narrative that an attack on the Saudi oil infrastructure is an attack on American national security interests. And it's deeply concerning. I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of play within the security establishment in the United States. The Saudis saying that the Houthis who claimed this attack did not actually do it, and it was an Iranian attack. The Saudis brought, for example, you know, bits of the drone onto Saudi television. And, you know, experts on sort of drone warfare say, well, yeah, it's possible that this is an Iranian drone, but it could also be one of the drones that is built by the Yemenis with the support of the Iranians. And sort of the whole idea that, well, the drones came from the north, you know, security experts again said that you can drive drones up and down in different directions, make them hover. So, you know, it's still very unclear. You know, even though the governments are, you know, the United States and Saudi Arabia are sort of claiming the Iranians did this, it's still, you know, very difficult to say. And it's, you know, I personally do not necessarily believe that Iranians were behind it. And, you know, of course, if the Houthis did it, they did it with Iranian technical expertise and Iranian support in a kind of general sense. But if we go down the path of like, you know, weapons supplied to one group, if that group attacks somebody, then the country that supplied the weapons is to blame. That's perhaps a path that Saudi Arabia doesn't necessarily want to go down, given the people that they have supplied military support to in the past. And more generally, from the Saudi perspective, blaming the Iranians kind of covers up the complete failure of their military adventure in Saudi in Yemen. You know, they have pumped millions and millions into warfare there. You know, the country's on the edge of starvation, and yet the Houthis are able to strike and, you know, seriously damage the Saudi economy.
And by the way, in a way that's legitimate in every, by any understanding of even of just basic international law. I mean, you know, the Saudis are, you know, waging a genocidal mass killing campaign. They're bombing hospitals, they're bombing schools, they're bombing children. They've led to cholera outbreaks. There are countries on the edge of starvation. All of that bloodshed is in the Saudis' hands, and it's entirely legitimate of a you know, ground a force to resist a foreign invader. I mean, you know, I'm sorry.
I would further note,
it's reality.
I would note that the Houthis, yeah. the Houthis, since this sort of attack, since this attack took place, the Houthis have declared that they won't launch further attacks on Saudi territory. But it is, let's say, a little bit strange to sort of imagine, you know, that you can attack a country and then not expect anything to come back to you. I mean,
right.
Yemen is right next to Saudi Arabia. Of course, if you're going to go to war with one of your neighbors, expect that there will be strikes back on your territory. It's the nature of warfare. As you say, this is hardly unexpected. And, you know, whether or not one supports any particular side in this, this seems entirely sort of normal consequence of the war that's taking place. So, you know, the Saudis, I think their desire to blame Iran is to a certain extent a function of the fact that this is a huge humiliation for them in military terms. They obviously, their military, although well-armed and, you know, has a lot of money behind it, is not anywhere near as effective as they would like to present it to the international community.
Final couple of minutes. I just want to touch a little bit on Kashmir. Imran Khan has stated now several times that India's, incredibly aggressive moves in Kashmir, which, I mean, should be, I mean, a lot of it's interpreted domestically, obviously, which is that the BJP Narendra Modi government has torn up the Indian constitution. They're going in and waging an aggressive human rights assault in Kashmir, which already was, by many estimates, the most militarized zone on earth. There's been a tech blackout. There's been, you know, children that have been blinded by rubber bullets. There's family separations. There's detentions. Even local moderate political leaders have been put in jail. And there's multiple interpretations of this. I mean, one part of it is there is obviously, you know, the extreme far right nationalist project, the Hindutva project of Modi and the BJP. And, you know, this, we go back to Modi and the Gujarat pogroms and mass murders and mass rapes of 2002. So this stuff is already, you know, quite on the public record for anybody who bothers to look it up. But how does this fit with Pakistani concerns? You know, in Pakistan, obviously Pakistan has certainly supported groups that engage in terrorism in India, including, I mean, the Oberoi Hotel atrocities in 2008. But there is, you know, the point is that there's a dimension of Kashmir that it's an atrocity and a problem in and of itself. But this really is the place. I mean, even more so than the Korean Peninsula, where the worst thing imaginable could actually happen. So, you know, where are we at?
I mean, the problems with India and Pakistan, of course, go back to the partition of the subcontinent in the late 1940s, and sort of Kashmir was one of those flashpoints, one of those areas which conflict between whether this should be part of India or Pakistan it emerged in violence. It was a Muslim majority province which was ruled by a Hindu prince, and according to the sort of partition scheme, in those provinces which were which the British had allowed to be ruled by indigenous monarchs, the princely states, the princes were allowed to decide, you know, which country their province would go into. So of course, you have a situation where the Kashmiri monarch brings Kashmir with its Muslim majority into India, and so this becomes a sort of bitter bone of contention between India and Pakistan. For example, Hyderabad, which was another princely state in India, was a ruled by a Muslim monarch. When the Muslim monarch chose to be part of Pakistan, the province was occupied by India. So there's a sort of long, rancorous history going back to the sort of partition era. And this, of course, is made all the more dangerous because both India and Pakistan are nuclearly armed powers. So we have in the 60s and 70s, you know, ongoing conflict, low-scale conflict. And of course, the people who get stuck in the middle of this are the Kashmiri population. And it strikes me that sort of more generally speaking, this assault by Modi on the Kashmiri population is an attempt in many ways to kind of bring about a final solution to the province, to the issue of Kashmir, by opening it up to sort of Indian settlement and diluting the Muslim population.
It's like Tibet sort of or Puerto Rico. It's gentrification and population displacement. Yeah.
I mean, this seems what the plan is. And of course, in an international environment where there isn't even any pretense of sort of a respect for human rights, this becomes, this becomes possible. You know, under a President Hillary Clinton, Modi might not have been so willing to make that leap to sort of escalate this conflict, because, you know, what's the comeback?
Well, however, I think it should be noted, right, that you know, you do have, I mean, Modi was just in the United States. He did a big event in Houston with Trump. He met with Steny Hoyer. He met with mainline Democrats. And of the presidential candidates, you know, as is the case, Bernie's spoken clearly and bravely on it. The other main contenders have had nothing to say. And then, you know, obviously, you know, Gabbard echoed the talking points of the RSS, which is the, you know, paramilitary organization that sort of, you know, oversees all of the ideological direction of the extreme variant in India, you know, led by Modi. And, you know, I'll add, I always struggle with it, but I mean, look at what Indonesia is doing in West Papua. You know, I mean, this is definitely a global dynamic right now.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing it with Erdogan attempting to sort of push 2-3 million Syrians into occupy Rojava and put 2-3 million Syrian Arabs there in order to dilute the Kurdish population there. We're seeing, as you mentioned, you know, people don't talk about the brutalities taking place in Western Papua. And of course, Kashmir is, again, part of this sort of newly aggressive nationalism, which is really taking hold. You know, as sort of the pretense of liberal internationalism breaks down, I think we're going to be seeing more and more of these kind of events as governments move without any fear of sort of international condemnation, move to sort of resolve these longstanding ethnic and religious conflicts in the most brutal way possible. And in India's case, Imran Khan, speaking on MSNBC today, he made the point that for many countries, India is a market of 1.2 billion people. So, you know, criticizing India has an economic cost to it as well.
Well, and we can add, of course, the just absolutely horrifying footage and stories emerging of, you know, China's, let's say, I mean, there's certainly deaths, but the detaining of Uyghurs is really essentially, I mean, it's cultural cleansing. The idea that we won't necessarily kill everybody, although some of that is taking place, but we are going to, you know, strip you of what you are in an aggressive, horrifying manner. And of course, you know, China, you know, that's even beyond just a powerful emerging market like, you know, India. I mean, China already, I mean, arguably we already are really in the G2 world. So,
it's very disturbing. And I think this isn't caused by the election of Trump or the, you know, ascendancy of the right wing in the United States, but it's certainly intensified by it and facilitated by it. So I think, you know, this is a very disturbing trend. And this is why, for example, the difference between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders on foreign policy is extremely critical to highlight. You know, there's a lot made about the how different they are on domestic policy, but it's the foreign policy dimension that really there's a very serious difference there. And a Sanders presidency may, we might hope, sort of help arrest some of the more sort of extreme manifestations of this intensification of violence and ethnic and religious conflict.
Gene Bajelan, from your lips to Allah's ears, I appreciate your time as always, professor of history at Missouri State University. Thanks so much, Gene.
Thank you so much.
Take care. All right, folks, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this whole thing happens. Bless you, Jamie. Check out Literary Hangover with the waterboat man himself, the literary scholar, the bon vivant, Matt Leck. check out the Michael Brooks Show, patreon.com/TMBS to get the whole thing. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Buy your tickets today for the Philadelphia Live Show, November 23rd, with Artesia Balthrop, Emma Viglin, and Crystal Ball. We're very excited to see you there. And I will also be putting out information soon on an event that I'm emceeing for Lauren Ashcroft, who is running for Congress. I believe that's on October 6th. I'll have more details forthcoming. Grab your tickets to Philly today. Become a patron today. Subscribe to YouTube today. Jamie, what's cooking?
Out now on the Antifada. We have an interview with Aaron Bastani from Novara Media about his new book, Fully Automated Luxury Communism, which is named after a meme that I believe he started, or at least he likes to take the credit for it. It was a very good conversation, if I do say so myself. We brought up some of the critiques that people have made of his ideas, as well as just like what he means when he says fully automated luxury communism. And that's out now. We also have a bonus coming out on Friday for our patrons that is taken from a conversation that Andy had with our friend Corey Pine this week, actually, on Corey's show, wherein they talk about Tom DeLonge's To the Stars Academy, the Navy acknowledging the existence of UFOs, and, of course, the topic of Andy's forthcoming book, Passadism. So that'll be out on Friday, which is tomorrow, for our patrons.
And has Andy fully embraced it at this point?
I mean, like, does he believe in it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, I mean, I think he's pretty skeptical
of
everything.
He's merged with his subject.
Yeah, okay. Maybe he went native with the Posadists.
He's
like
merged
Howard
with his subject. Yep.
The aliens, the space comrades. Yeah, I mean, he was kind of babbling about it the other day in a way that concerned me. So maybe you're right. Yeah. But also, if you want to see him do that live in person, you can come to our live show at Littlefield it's 2 weeks from now. Holy crap. And we're doing that with Pod Damn America, as well as some really awesome guests, including Matt Chrisman, Virgil Texas, Simone Norman, Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session. Oh my God. And a subversive drag performance from Comrade Barbie. It's going to be great, folks.
Very cool. That is jam-packed. Awesome. All right,
folks.
Very
excited.
We're going to see you in the postgame. No, on the fun half. This is not TMBS. I'm sorry.
Left is best.